Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. The East Area rapist would break into middle-class homes and respectable neighborhoods in the dark of night, tie up his victims, and tell them over and over they were going to die. Well, he didn't kill them, and didn't kill anyone, not at first. The East Area rapist got his start in the summer of 1976 in Sacramento County and raped 30 women between June 1976 and July 1978. He moved on to Contra Costa County in October 1978, then continued south to Santa Barbara and Orange counties, where he was known as the Night Stalker, named before his crimes were linked to those up north. Psychiatrists helping the task force talked with imprisoned sex offenders who said East Area rapist was looking for an excuse to kill, not just to rape. They were right. Larry Crompton was working in the crime lab in Contra Costa County doing crime scene investigations when East Area Rapist arrived in late 1979. After Ear's third attack, a task force of local police agencies, the DA's office, and the crime lab was formed, and Crompton was appointed to it. The first murder was a double homicide in Santa Barbara County in December 1979. His attacks continued until after another double homicide in 1981, the East Area Rapist vanished for 5 years. He reappeared for another double homicide in May 1986. Larry Crompton had retired, but in May 2000, he got a call from a criminologist in Contra Costa County who was working with DNA and the Ear files. Crompton gave him the names of three rape victims, and by July, it was confirmed that the same man was behind them. Further DNA worked proved in 2001 that 6 of the 10 murders then attributed to Ear were by the same person. And in April 2002, the Orange County Sheriff's Office flew Crompton down to help with the investigation. The East Area Rapist, or original Night Stalker, has yet to be arrested. The book we're featuring this evening is Sudden Terror, with my special guest, police officer and author Larry Crompton. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Larry Crompton.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate you having me on.
I apologize because there was a little bit of confusion in what I was reading. You a retired detective or lieutenant? What would you want to be considered retired from the police force?
The main thing is retired, but I did retire as a lieutenant.
Okay.
But working on the task force, I was a sergeant.
Ah, I see. I got it. Okay. Okay, now let's get to when this happened in 1976. Where were you, and what was your impression of the first, when you first heard about the first rapes that were heard, that occurred in 1976? Where were you, and what were your thoughts at that time?
At that time, I knew nothing about it. Things were different then than what they are now. If you didn't live in the town or close to it or didn't get that newspaper, you didn't hear about these things. Contra Costa is not that far from Sacramento, but we knew nothing about the East Area Rapist and knew nothing until August of 1978 when the sergeant that was in charge of their task force, Sergeant Jim Bevins, and the lieutenant, Ray Root, came down to Concord and had a meeting with us. And at that time, I was working in the crime lab, and the sheriff asked if I would go to that meeting, and one of the criminalists with me. And that's the first time we heard about it. And again, sitting there and listening to them tell us about rapes that occurred in Sacramento, and all we could think of is we're in Contra Costa County. We don't have people like that down here, so this isn't going to bother us. We learned differently.
Right. Now, in terms of the crime scene investigation, I know that, as far as I know, it's a part of a, you're part of a team. What area of expertise do you have, and what, in terms of your contribution and your job in this team doing crime scene investigations?
Well, what my job was to go to crime scenes, and we would process them, fingerprints and photographs and things like that. And also, one of the things that I had to do in homicides was to go to the take pictures of the murdered victim as the doctors are working on him, doing the autopsies, and I would have to photograph them. But mainly it was to go to the scene and do the processing of the scenes. Prior to that, I had no experience in it at all. I got to the crime lab, saw some of the books that they were reading, and I couldn't even pronounce them. But the crime lab in Contra Costa County was an excellent one, and the people that were in there were excellent and worked with me very well and took me under their arm and taught me what I needed to know.
Now, you say there was things were different in those days if a crime occurred in a certain county. Were we talking, for those people that don't know the expanse of distance in California, the difference between northern and southern California in terms of distance between where he started in Sacramento and where you were, what kind of mileage are we talking about? How many counties away, or how? What's the distance?
Well, there's only one county between us, and that's Solano County. So you can get there within, well, because of the traffic in California is going to take a little longer than what you would think. But within a couple hours, you could be there.
Okay. So take us back to June 17th. I know that you just mentioned that you really didn't know about that, but take us back like you were there in June 17, 1976, because you do a great job of, obviously there are 10 murders here, but there's also a multitude of rapes, and then you talk about the escalation, so where he started and where he ended up as a rapist killer, serial rapist killer. But June 17th, you talk about Cary Frank, and tell us about Cary Frank, and this is an amazing part of the book where you have the opportunity because she survived, and gives you the details, and you've written about that in the book. So tell us about Cary Frank and June 17th, 1976.
Well, Cary was home alone. Her father was out of town, and she didn't expect him back for a while. And she thought that she was being watched in May of 1976. And she received several hang-up phone calls for 2 weeks before the attack. And she felt that somebody was watching her, but because of the phone calls, she was very, very nervous. And this night when he did come in, when she first was awoken, she thought it was her father, but obviously it wasn't. And prior to him getting in, he tried to cut the phone line going into the house, and that is something that he did in many of the attacks, is that he would disable the phone so that they couldn't call.
Right.
He tied her up like he did all of them after that. And one thing about this is his modus of doing this in the first attack, he got a little more sophisticated, but it was the same way. He tied her hands behind her back extremely tight. He tied her ankles very loose, and he talked through clenched teeth, told her that all he wanted was food and money, and didn't want to hurt her and wasn't going to hurt her. And he didn't blindfold her. In other ones, he did. He started blindfolding. But in this one here, he asked her, "Do you have money?" He ransacked the house. And one thing that in this attack and the ones afterwards, he always lubricated himself. And this victim here, Cary Frank, and all the ones after that all said that he was very small endowed, very tiny, and never did have a full erection in any of these attacks. She could describe him only that he wore a dark T-shirt and dirty white or gray ski mask with holes for the eyes. And when he woke her up, he had no pants on. He did have his tennis shoes on, but no pants. And this is something that that he did in rapes after that also, but not in every one.
Now, did he say right from the very first with Carrie Frank, you're going to die? Did he threaten her?
Yes, he did. He threatened every one of them, and my feeling is that is what he wanted to do right from the start, was to kill, but did not. And in talking to a psychiatrist later on at the Vacaville Medical Center, she told me she had talked to her sex offenders at the medical center, and they all said, you had better catch him because he wants to kill. And I asked her, why hasn't he? And she said, well, he does not yet have the justification. Once he gets the justification, he's going to kill. And I said, will he kill every time? And she said, no, but the justification will be less each time. So Carrie Frank, that was the one thing that she really had in her mind during all of this, was she was going to die. And that's what he put in each one of their minds, whether it was the woman or the man and the woman, they were going to die.
Now, was Carrie compliant to his orders, was she struggling? What would she opt to do?
She was compliant because she was extremely frightened. She did what she had to do to stay alive. And in talking to some of them, that's what I told them, that you had to go along with it. If not, you would have died. And that's the way it was up until he started the killings.
What was the general size of this man in terms of Carrie Frank's description of him, sort of weight and height?
He was about 5'9", 5'10", and probably about 170 pounds. And they all come out about the same way, and felt that he was not old. Could have been anywhere from 19, 20, 25 years old. And other than that, they couldn't really tell because they didn't see him. He always wore the mask. He always wore gloves. We never got fingerprints from him, and never got a real good description of him. And what he would do is he would use a flashlight to wake them up a lot of times. And he would either tap on the door sill or he would say something to them and shine the light in their eyes. And then a lot of times he would blindfold them, but he would put them on their stomachs and tie their hands behind their back extremely tight. And on Carrie Frank, along with the rest of them, it cut the blood circulation off to their hands. Very, very painful.
Now, how long did the attack, how long would this attack last?
It would depend. It could last 2 to 3 hours. It depends on what was going on. If it was a single female, then obviously it didn't take as long as if there was a man in the house. And sometimes what you'll find in reading the book, sometimes if things were not going exactly the way that he wanted them to, he would leave. And he had this system going, and he had to follow it.
Now, getting back to Carrie Frank, how is it that she escapes, and she believes that she's going to die, so she acts accordingly when she has an opportunity. He's ransacking the place. Tell us what happens.
Well, while he is ransacking, she is listening, but she's not doing anything. And she was just, that night, she was just looking forward to a good night. And then he comes in, and it just was horrible for her. The house obviously was lonely because her father was not there, and she fell asleep in the room, and just out of the darkness, this figure came in, and when he stood in the house, like I say, it's just he was half naked. Moved through the house and went to her room, and in this case, he tapped on the doorway, and that woke Carrie up, brought her out of a sound sleep, and her bedroom light flashed on. He turned that on, and she was just scared to death, dulled her senses. And she said she looked into his eyes, although, like I say, he had a mask, but she could see into his eyes. She could see the knife that he had. She knew that he had gloves on, and he just continued tapping against the door frame. And he had an erect penis, and that obviously drew her attention, but again, she described it as very small. And she said that she was unable to form thoughts, and he leaped onto her bed. And she tried to pull the covers up over her head and to protect herself from what she felt was like an awful nightmare. And unfortunately, the nightmare didn't leave. And he took the blankets off of her, and he just stared at her. And she said her ears were ringing, and he told her, if you make one move, if you make one sound, I'll stick this knife in you. And she said that when he talked, and she mentioned the same as others, that it seemed like he was talking through clenched teeth. And he just moved to the side of her bed and pointed at her nightgown and said, take it off. And unfortunately, at that time, it was her period, and he told her to take the Tampax out. It didn't seem to bother him in the least. He just whispered, take it out. And then he told her to roll over and grabbed her arms, and she could feel the gloved hands, and the rope just bit into her wrist like it does with all of them from then on. She kept her eyes closed. Said she didn't want to open them. She didn't want to look at them. She just wanted it to go away, and said it wasn't the rape that she would remember most. It wasn't the rape that would make her want to scream and leave in the middle of the night. It was a terror he left her with, and that terror was that she was going to die. And that was one of the things that she could not get out of her mind. And he kept asking her, do you have money? Do you have money? And when she tried to answer, he told her to shut up. And she could hear him rummaging in the bedroom. And this is things that he did. And just tied her ankles up so she couldn't get out of bed. And then rummaged some more in the bedroom. And he put the knife near her eye and said, don't make a move while I'm here, or I'll kill you. And he kept telling her, I'll kill you, I'll kill you. And she just, the way that he did on this one here, we believe, and we're pretty sure of this, he talked as though there was somebody else in the room with him, in the house with him. But I don't think that was happening. I think it was him, and this was just something that he tried. And that was it. And
it's kind of interesting that it must have been interesting to police that he wasn't that interested about DNA, but then we're talking about 1976, though, but he's not very cautious. He doesn't use a condom.
Well, we didn't have DNA back then. We didn't know about DNA back then. So there really wasn't a problem that way. There was nothing that could have helped. The only thing that we did find out was that he was a non-secretor, and non-secretors about 20% of the population. And through non-secretors, you can't get the blood type through any secretion. So I'm sure he didn't know he was a non-secretor. But other than that, if we had not kept this evidence, we never would have been able to figure out anything about him. And so he didn't have to worry about that, and he didn't worry about it. And like I say, he lubricated himself on these attacks, and sometimes he brought the lubricant with him, and sometimes he used what they had in the bathroom. Sometimes he would break into the house when they weren't home and set it up and leave shoelaces hidden someplace. And leave a door or a window unlocked that normally wasn't unlocked, and then he would come back later and go in once they fell asleep. Same thing with Carrie Frank. He waited until she was asleep. I'm sure he was outside that house for a long time, waiting for her to go to sleep. This isn't something that he would just arrive at the house and go in. And with Carrie Frank and with others, the hang-up phone calls that they received is something that showed up in a lot of them also. So we know that he was in the neighborhoods. He was canvassing the neighborhoods. And he would see somebody that would get into his mind, and that's where he was going to go. And my feeling is that once he made up his mind who he was going after, he would get that person. And like I've said, I believe that if he had to, he would have gone down the chimney. But he was going to go into that house one way or the other, and he was going after that person.
Now, we just talked about Carrie Frank, but you were talking about the similarities. Did he use sort of Carrie Frank, or did it seem like the first rapes were sort of a template? He seemed to work out whatever little challenges that he had, and then, but you say he proceeded fairly methodically and carefully, and if he thought something was off, he would leave. So tell us, as it progresses in 1976, what becomes his sort of, you've already talked about his MO, but is it very similar, and were the first rapes sort of a template of success, and so he continues like that? Tell us how it really works.
Well, my feeling on it is that he had to have known what he was going to do before he put this together. As I got into it and was working on the task force, I thought nobody could have just started out this way. And we know through psychiatrists and all that most of them start out with peeping Toms and then maybe go to killing animals or whatever, and then get into this. But my feeling was that because of the way that he did it and the template that he had, it was a good thing that maybe he'd been in prison for something else and had worked this out with other prisoners and figured out the best way to do it. Because of that, I got the names of parolees over a six-month period and went through them. It didn't do me any good. So maybe that wasn't it. But he did have this plan worked out. And he stayed with that plan. Now, when he first started, obviously, it was a single female. And I think he wanted to be known. He wanted this out there. He wanted the publicity. And as the newspaper did finally pick it up and put in there that there was always single females and no male in the home, his next attack was one with a male in the home. So, obviously, he had been to school because he could read, and other than that, we didn't have much on him at all, and it was very, very frustrating.
Did he, as many of these guys do, serial rapists, serial killers, did he do any taunting of police or victims? You said he had hang-up calls beforehand, so just to check out who he was choosing as a victim. But is there any indication he kept trophies or anything that some of the other serial killers seem to have share characteristically?
Yes. One of the things that we found that he did take was driver's licenses or ID cards from colleges of the women. He would take jewelry. He took money. But the strange thing is, obviously, it wasn't for the money. There was one incident where they had a lot of money, and he took half of it. And there were times when he really was irritated because he couldn't get a diamond ring off one of the victim's fingers. And she tried to tell him, put soap on it, do this, do that, and he couldn't get it off. He finally got it off, and he told her, if I can't get this off, I'll cut your finger off. Before he left the house, he just threw the ring on the floor. It wasn't the ring that he was after. It was the terror that he was after. And in every one of his attacks, terror was number one. Rape was in the back of his mind, obviously.
Now, right from the very beginning, you talk about, there's many stories where police have no idea. In hindsight, everybody's a genius, but initially, was there any, how long did it take police to realize that there was a sophisticated, maybe serial rapist at work, and how long did it take them to figure that out?
It was probably three or four rapes before Sacramento Sheriff's Office finally put it together. I think Jim Bevins, the sergeant at that time that was in investigation, I think he probably was the one that that finally said, uh-oh, we have something going here, and we better be ready. And once they got into it, then they spent millions of dollars looking for this person. And over time, that the officers didn't even put in for because they wanted to catch him. These are deputies on the street, the detectives, whatever. They knew that they had somebody, and they knew in their mind that before long, somebody was going to get killed. And it wasn't too long after that that, remember, in the book, 16-year-old boy was shot.
Right.
And what happened there, the people in a house heard somebody in the backyard and saw him and chased him, the father and the son. And the son was faster than the father, and the rapist got over the fence, and the boy got to the fence, climbed up on it, and he was crouched on the other side, pointing the gun up, and shot the boy. Fortunately, he lived, but what psychiatrists told us was that he will kill. He will not be caught. He will kill police officers. He'll kill anybody, and then if that fails, he'll kill himself. But he does not want to get caught. And so we knew that he would shoot. And that was February of 77 that he shot that kid. So, it was near the beginning. And
Right away, analysts looking at this, because I could see where they could get that conclusion, too, if he'd shoot a 16-year-old boy instead of continuing to run. Could have continued to run, but he shot him. So
yes.
Tried to kill him, and so from there, it's not much of a leap to say, well, maybe he doesn't want to be in prison. So they were right in all their predictions, at least with this profiling of this guy.
Yes.
Now, how big a story is this in California? And in terms of in the counties, it's probably a big thing. But how big is this story by 1977, the 16-year-old boy chasing after a perpetrator? You have a serial rapist on the loose in California here. How big a story is this by media? How interesting is this to the media?
Not. It is to Sacramento, but that's it. not nationwide and not out to the Bay Area. It wasn't in the San Francisco paper, and we knew nothing about it. Like I say, today, if somebody shoots a dog back in Florida, we're going to hear about it on the news that night. Back then, things like this happened, and it was not the big thing. It was not in the news and didn't cover. And agencies didn't contact each other to tell them what was going on either. So it was very difficult.
I thought it was odd, too. East Area Rapist sounds pretty ordinary compared to all the nicknames that these killers get saddled with. I thought he might be disappointed by that almost.
Well, I think he probably called himself even the East Side Rapist in one of the conversations. So it could have been that. I don't think that he cared about the name. I think he cared about what was going on. And those are other things that happened in one of the attacks. He told the woman, this hadn't better get out. He told the husband, this had better get out. I'm going to kill a cop, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to kill two people tomorrow night. And so none of it really made sense. It was just something that went on. Things that he did do during these attacks, and some of them he stuttered. Some of them he seemed to cry and sobbed, and one of them said, when Mummy sees this, it bothers her, it makes her mad on TV. Whether this is something that he made up, we don't know. No way of telling.
But it's from the witnesses that did have interaction with him, it seems that it's fairly nonsensical.
Oh,
like
yeah.
You say, he takes the ring off, throws it down. So, I mean, he's very...
Yeah. And like I say, he only took part of the money. Didn't always take money. And the first time that I noticed that anything was different was when he did move down to our area, down in the Bay Area, in Contra Costa. In the first attack down there, he took things that you would need to set up an apartment. Things that he had never done before, pots and pans, that type thing. That was not anything that he did before. So it looked like he started out in Sacramento. We believe he lived in Sacramento, in the county. He moved to Contra Costa County. We believe he probably lived in Concord while he was there, because Concord is a central point. And then he moved to Goleta area in Santa Barbara and in 79. So anybody that has a friend or a relative or whatever that they know lived in Sacramento in 76, 77, 78, moved to Contra Costa County in 78, 79, and then moved to Southern California in 79, not too many people can do that. And with this person, he spent most of the time, his attacks were at night. Did he work during the day? Obviously, he had money of some kind. Different cars were sighted, and never seemed to be the same one. He did mention a van in many of his attacks, but wasn't seen. Volkswagen had been seen, Pontiac, that type thing. So it was different cars most of the time. And so how he would come across that, I don't know. But what we have to understand is that in 1976, when he was hitting in Sacramento, there were over 300 rapes reported in that area in 1976, and probably over 2,000 unreported rapes in that area. So he wasn't the only one, and they did a study, and they said that 66% of rapes are probably not reported, and that was 13 cities that they looked at that time. So in 1976, forcible rapes that were reported in California, 9,500 and some were reported. 45% were cleared. And Ear was not the most active one. He was just the most violent. And that was the one thing that you have to understand about East Area Rapist, or Ear as we called him. He was, from the very first, violent. He wanted to kill. He wanted to kill, and he was going to kill. And the reason that I think that he finally did, and I'm jumping ahead of you here, the reason that I think that he finally did was the last attack that he made in Contra Costa County, the people got away. Then he moved to Goleta, where he attacked a couple down there, and they got away. And I believe that in his mind it was nobody is ever going to get away again. And the psychiatrist that I talked to at the Vacaville Medical Center that said he needed the justification, I think she was true, and that was a justification that he needed. And from then on, it was the killing. And that's what he entered the house for, was to kill. And in the 70s, we had the early morning rapist in Sacramento, and he was never identified, and he raped 36 women. But again, right, they were on welfare, divorced, lower income. The woolly rapist, Sacramento, called him that because of a wet wool odor, and had him count 100 backwards after he placed him in the closet. And he was arrested within a month. LAPD had a pillowcase rapist, 54 women. And he was finally sentenced to 25 years, got out, and in 1995, and in 1997, he was arrested in Indiana for rape. Berkeley had the stinky rapist at the same time. He had the car key rapist. He raped more than 40 women and was caught. And San Diego PD had the East San Diego rapist. Dallas had the friendly rapist. And they were all going on at the same time. We didn't know about them. We had never heard about them. I didn't know about them until later on when I was starting to write the book and started checking on these. And what they say is that 17% of women are victims of rape. 50% of them are under 17 years old. That's over 17 million people.
Wow.
And so the rapists are out there. It's just that this one here was so violent that he came to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think with today's knowledge of these guys, because I know that FBI profilers out of Quantico were doing stuff, Robert K. Ressler and Douglas were doing stuff in the 70s with guys that had been arrested, like Gacy and Bundy and Dahmer and all these guys. So that's just the beginning of them interviewing those guys and then creating profiling. Was there any kind of victim type at all that he seemed to be interested in?
The only thing that I can say on this is that he did not go for low income, did not go for prostitutes, did not go for that. He went for middle class, upper middle class people safe in their homes. He would go into an area and knew what that area was and knew what type of person was in that area. And that's what he was after. Other than that, nothing. And we have the FBI is trying to do a profile for us on this one now, but they say it'll take at least another 6 months before they can come up with anything. And again, it probably isn't going to lead us anywhere other than to say this is the type of person that you're looking for. And
it'd be interesting what their take is on the likely occupation, because it would have to be fairly specific. I mean, to be able to, like you say, it's unusual. The way he had the means, he had this, he could have a certain schedule, and obviously had some money, and the, but yet he's moving around California. So that it seems to be a specific type of occupation, some kind of self-employment to a certain degree.
Yes, it could be self-employment. It one thing that I tried to look at was possibly at that time he was in the military. And that would have been an opportunity. It's like one of the victims that he had, Frances Woods in the book. She was a reserve captain in the military. Her husband was a regular captain in the military, and their main base was in Fairfield, even though they lived in Sacramento. Could it have been? We don't know. We do know that at times, most of the time he wore tennis shoes, but sometimes he wore boots that the victim said looked like military-type boot. One time he had a baton and in one of the attacks. But that doesn't prove anything. It's just something to look at. And the problem that we had back then, and I'm not sure that it's changed today, is that agencies need to work together. And unfortunately, they didn't, and that puts you behind. It's when Jim Bevins, the sergeant with Sacramento, heard about the double homicide down in Santa Barbara County and called down there, and they said, no, we didn't have anything like that. We don't know what you're talking about. I called. They said the same thing. And it was a couple of months later that Bevins found out that, yes, they did have the double homicide, and just about the same time, I found out that they had the attempted rape where the people got away. And then we got the reports, and the reports were just the same as our reports. The ski mask, the tie-up, the terror on the ones that got away, the dishes that he would put on their back, that type thing. And that's one of the other things that he started doing when a man was also in the house. He would put dishes on their back and say, if I hear these, I'll kill you. If I hear these, I'll kill her. If I hear these, if there was a child in the house, if I hear these, I'll cut your child's ears off and bring them to you. And they all believed it. They knew that that was going to happen. Now, some of the ones I could talk to, I would go in and I would see, and in my mind I'd say, okay, these people are going to handle it. They'll be okay. Other people you go in and you say, this marriage is not going to last. And most of the time it was because the husband felt in his mind, I should have taken care of my wife, and I didn't. And I'd try to explain to him, if you did, you'd both be dead. You did what you had to do. But for them to get that in their head would be almost impossible. And so many of them ended up in divorce, unfortunately. One of them that you'll find in my book, married, had children, very, very pretty girl. And when I talked to her, I thought, this rape didn't seem to bother her. She seemed to get excited from it. And 2 years later, I was called by the state narcotics team and asked me if I would go to him on a search warrant, and I did, and went in there and found pictures of her with her doper boyfriend. She'd left her husband and went the other way, and those are things that you just don't understand how it could happen, whether it was because of what happened or what, I don't know, but...
Well, he certainly described the terror, but also the trauma. I mean, this is a good point. I mean, why these people just—it's unfathomable. It's this terror that's and trauma that lives with these people forever. Tell us. I wanted to know about you. You talk about this major point departure for this serial rapist ear when he has four escapees. Now, explain how he can go from this planning the very, at least what would you consider the first one in 76, Is he devolving? Is he getting less organized, like very much like a serial killer? Is this period of there was organized and then there's disorganized? Is he making less sense? I know that he responded to the media. There's no men at the crime scene. So then next crime he has men involved. So tell us about this. Is it a devolution? Is it what's happening with him that he has four escapees?
He became more brazen. I think he got excitement from what he was doing, and with a man in the house, it was just one more thing for him to deal with and overcome and be in charge of. And some of the ones, the one that got away in Contra Costa County, he and his wife had worked out an escape route in case something like this happened, and it did happen. And fortunately, the husband woke up while the rapist was standing there pulling the mask over his face and didn't have the gun in his hand. And he jumped up out of bed and started screaming at him, and it kind of surprised the rapist, obviously, and he kept screaming at him, and the wife at that time took the escape route and got away. This fellow was big enough where he could have picked up the East Area rapist and thrown him out the window, but he didn't. Once his wife got away, then he felt, okay, she's safe, now I'm going to be safe, and he ran also, and walked out of the house and left. Things that happened to him, like one of the attacks, there were kids playing outside. They were extremely noisy, and because of that, it threw him off, and he did not sexually attack the lady, and only because of the racket that was going on outside, it bothered him. So he had to have that in his mind of what he was going to do and how he was going to do it. And he followed that. He got more sophisticated as he went along, but did not change his pattern at all. Knew he was always going to have a mask, knew he was always going to wear gloves, and did not leave fingerprints, and did not let anybody see him. And he raped a 13-year-old twice. He raped two 13-year-olds. That's unbelievable. And one that was 16 years old, he thought that she was somebody else. He thought she was a college student. He took her down to the field and was dealing with her down there, and finally she got through to him that, I'm a high school person. It was not who he wanted. He left. He didn't rape her.
Wow.
So it's
incredible.
A lot of strange things.
Sounds like your book really does read like a Criminal Minds episode. I mean, a lot of people that read true crime also watch these programs because there's this, you know, some truth to this stuff. I mean, it's amazing, though, that some of this stuff, it could be plots for some of these fictitious Criminal Minds and other programs like that. Now, tell us about the murders. What's the first murder characterized by? And tell us about the first murders.
Well, in the murders, like I say, because the two got away. From then on, that was it. And in the Offerman Manning, it was a double homicide, and he shot them. And I think in that case, he learned that using a gun makes a noise. And from then on, he didn't shoot, he bludgeoned to death. One other time he had to use a gun because I think the person got free and tried to attack him. But in Offerman and Manning, they were found shot to death in their condominium. And it was not too far from the first Goleta attack, as a matter of fact. And the victims were both bound. And indications were that the male victim, Mr. Offerman somehow got his bindings loose, and he lunged at Ear, and Ear shot him, and then shot the female. And unlike all the other attacks where the woman was taken away from the husband, away from the male, to a different room, in this one here they were both in the bedroom. So it indicated that he did not have time to do anything before he killed him. The husband got free, and or the boyfriend got free, and he had to shoot him. And that was when he started making a few changes. And after that, when he went into the house, he went in with one intent. That intent was to kill, but that intent was to beat him to death. And he would bludgeon them, hit them in the head, and kill them that way. And then in one other one, bindings got loose, and it looked like Greg Sanchez tried to attack him, and he shot him. That didn't kill him, and then he bludgeoned him to death, and then bludgeoned the woman to death. So it was, he had that in his head, and I don't understand how it went that way. My feeling today, I've been asked many, many times, do you think he's still alive? My feeling is that if he had moved back east, he could still be killing, and they never would have put it together. If he killed in one city and then went to another city and then to another city, probably would not be put together, because now one thing that he did learn at the end was to take the bindings when he left. Originally, they, when the people were still living, of course, they had to be bound, and he made sure that he was within easy distance of a freeway or whatever, so that he knew they couldn't get loose within 5 or 10 minutes, and he would be gone. So they obviously would be left tied. But once he started murdering after the first two, then he started taking the bindings with him, so didn't even have those left. And for years, I would wake up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning wondering, what did I do wrong? What did I miss? Why did I miss it? It just doesn't leave you. Things like this stay with you the rest of your life. And the reason I wrote the book was to get the investigation going again. And I went self-publishing because it's faster that way, and I just wanted it out. I didn't do it to make money on it, obviously. And it was just something that I had to do. These people need closure, and it's not about me. It's not about the cops that work this. It's about the victims and the victims' families. And this person has got to be caught, at least identified, so they can find closure. Can you imagine a 13-year-old having to live the rest of her life knowing that that she was raped by this person and not even know who he is? Or why she was attacked, or anything like that. So very, very, very difficult, hard to live with. And things that if there's anybody out there that says, I know somebody that lived in those areas, you know, then they're the ones that we need. And we need a description, we need a name, we need information. We've been on TV. There's been the A&E cold case that put one out. E-Network, True Hollywood Investigates, put one out. And there's going to be another one in probably in March. Dark Minds is going to put one out. And hopefully something will come out of this. And now your radio program, I think, is probably one of the best ways for something to come out. And I just really, really appreciate you taking the time to contact me. And and get into this.
Well, actually, you know, the credit has to go to one of the listeners of the program, so I think you're very right that there could be a possibility that this might certainly lead to something. Who knows? But someone told me about your book and your investigation, so then I looked, and I said, wow, I knew nothing about this, and so we went from there. And so this person didn't want to be identified, but I did contact him recently and said, listen, thanks to you, Larry's going to be on the program talking about his excellent book here. So, and she said, well, I'll be looking forward to that. So,
oh, great. There is something that if you don't mind putting out, anybody that does have any information, they can do serial killer clues at ocsd.org, and that's Orange County Sheriff's Department, and they have teams that will look into it and take it from there.
And I'm sure if somebody were to listen to the program as well, they could always contact me. I could contact you, so it's there's ample ways they could do that. Now, you talk about this has been 34 years since you were first introduced to this East Area Rapist.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you've been retired since. You've been retired since. When did you retire?
I retired in 1998, and it wasn't until I retired and moved here to Oregon that had the opportunity. A criminalist called me and said, "I understand you're on the task force. Can you give me some names?" And I did. And then he said, "Yep, it's we showed DNA." And I said, "Okay, I know if you can get some criminalist in Southern California to work with you. I know the murders down there are our man." And I knew of five. And he called me back months later and said, no, they didn't have five. They had 10. And he said, we've already linked six of them with DNA. And that's when they flew me down there. And the thing is, I kept all the reports. They were being thrown out by my department.
Yeah.
And I got there just at the right time as they were being thrown out, and I said, no, I'm keeping those, and I've had them with me ever since. And that's the only reason that that the reports were there for Orange County. And once they got involved, I thought, okay, now we have a chance. And then when E! Entertainment was putting the show on, I said, okay, my book isn't printed yet, but I'll give you my manuscript. You can use it. And they used it for the show. And
oh, great.
So it's really going on now. It is being investigated again, and that's why I wrote it. And I just pray each day that somebody's going to come forward.
Yes, I really hope that that could come true. That would be a somewhat happy ending, because they're never really, like you say, there's no real happy endings for victims or victims' families at all. But just for the peace of mind of the dedicated officers who are on that task force and people that were living with people on that task force, as you say, I think they've made dozens and dozens of television series or episodes and movies about this same sort of thing, the toll it takes on the officers as they take it very, very personally. And yet at the same time, it pales, and you've written about that in the book, that it pales in comparison to the pain that these people have to. So you reminded yourself of that.
Oh, yes, definitely. I finally realized it wasn't about me, and it's about them. And I do stay in contact. One of the ladies that was attacked stays in contact with me, and she's doing very well. She's one of the ones that did survive and doing very well. So let's just hope.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Now, have you a website that people could go to about any more information? Or again, give that.
They can go to EarOns, AETV Community, and they'll be able to connect. EARONS.
Okay, great. And your book is through Author House, self-published,
yes,
but through Author House, so, and also through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it online. Is it an e-book form as of yet?
Yes, it is.
Kindle edition as well? So it's in soft cover?
Yeah, it's in soft cover, hardcover, and ebook.
Oh, great. So people can get it any way they wish. So that's
yes.
great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this book, Sudden Terror. You really, really captured, again, the essence of the man that's still living with this case. Like you say, you've had nightmares, you've had dreams, you've had, and you're still saying prayers that somebody out there will make this connection and at least get some kind of closure for people. And it would just be sort of a nice thing that's, for all the work and dedication and all the time that has been put in and all the victimization and, again, terror that this person has inflicted on all of California, basically. So I want to thank you very much for coming on the program, Larry, and best of luck with this.
And thank you, Dan, very much.
Okay, well, you have a great evening. Thank you very much, Larry. Have a good night.
You too. Yeah. Bye now.
Bye.